ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this afternoon is Vance against Rumsfeld. Counsel, we have Counsel, we have a problem with the lighting system in this court today. The white and red lights are not working. The white and orange lights are not working. So I'm going to just tell you when you've got 5 minutes, when you have 1 minute, and when you have to sit down. Okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Loeb.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Loeb from the Department of Justice, and I represent the United States and the former Secretary of Defense in this appeal. The district court here erred in holding that a court acting on its own should recognize a common law cause of action for damages to permit a former military detainee to sue other military officials for damages regarding their treatment while in military detention during an act of war.
Other military personnel? The plaintiff is a citizen, correct? Civilian citizen?
To sue military personnel.
But who's not part of the military himself.
Absolutely, Your Honor. They were held as security detainees during an active conflict in Iraq, obviously. The question is whether a court on its own should provide such a damage remedy, even though Congress has not done so. As the Fourth Circuit recently held in LeBron, a claim about military detention during an active armed conflict presents numerous special factors that, when looked at together in the aggregate, strongly counsel against a court on its own creating a damage action where Congress has not provided any. This is not a question of whether there was a constitutional violation or not. And I would say the separation of powers concern is what, in Bush versus Lucas said, is the question of who should decide whether there is a damage action, a damage remedy that should apply, not whether there's a constitutional violation and not the question of whether there's immunity. The question of whether a court should defer to the legislature to legislate a remedy when Congress hasn't provided one.
So do you think it's tolerable for there to be no remedy? Suppose that the Secretary of Defense had issued an order saying that assassination would be fine for people who were deemed unloyal to the United States. And let's just suppose that that would be incompatible with things like the Detainee Treatment Act. Your view is that it's fine that there be no remedy for that.
Well, I think in this case we have to focus on that we have conduct that is the question of how interrogations were conducted during an armed conflict, what the interrogation policies were.
Well, not really. Because the rule that you're arguing for is a rule of absolute unaccountability. And I just want to know whether you really want to stick with that, no matter what hypotheticals. Perhaps that wasn't this case, well, but next year or the year after or the year after that,
first of all,
there
is
a case.
Political accountability among the political branches.
But that's not.
You mean after someone is dead? Is that what you mean?
Well, let's take Stanley, for example. Stanley was a case where it was a human experimentation with LSD on the plaintiffs without their consent. Justice O'Connor compared it to the...
And the plaintiffs were members of the military.
They were members of the military. Justice O'Connor compared it to...
The Ferris Doctrine said that they couldn't use that remedy. You sign up for the military, you sign up for the Ferris Doctrine.
Well, among the people who were responsible, because we're not all military, as the dissent points out and as the majority in Stanley recognizes, not all the defendants in that case would have been military officials.
He's talking about the plaintiff, though. The plaintiff received those injuries when he was in the military.
Right.
That's not these people. These people were non-military.
But Stanley did not rest on that fact. It also looked at as to whether the nature of the case would require a court to have a judicial inquiry into military affairs matters.
Well, it was very correct. If that's correct, Mr. Loeb, I think what you're arguing for is that Bivens simply never applies to any military activity, isn't it? Isn't that what you're arguing? You've taken that position in the LeBron Padilla case.
We would say that if regarding activities taken during an armed conflict, that if Congress wants to provide a remedy, a damage remedy, it can. But that is a quintessential area
Why don't you just say you're right, Judge Hamilton? I mean, that you shouldn't mind saying, yes, our position is that there's never a Bivens remedy in this situation. And if you think that the word never is wrong, I'd be fascinated to know when you think there might be one.
Well, I would say never as to actions taken during an armed conflict regarding the detention and the interrogation of individuals held as military detainees in that conflict.
But it wouldn't matter if the plaintiffs were vacationing in England, let's say, when they were picked up by the military on the same suspicion, sent to a military prison in Iraq where they were detained without process and tortured. That wouldn't change anything.
Well, we know Padilla was...
What?
We know Padilla...
Why don't you answer the question?
Yes, please.
Well,
it's sort of a yes or no.
That if they're picked up as part of a military conflict, in that case, as the enemy, that would be a case like Padilla, where we have argued, and the Fourth Circuit held, that that those kind of allegations are extreme, they can be shocking, but if there is to be a damage remedy provided, it has to be, as a matter of deference to the legislature, a kind of action like that involves sensitive policy questions.
It doesn't. Congress has already said, and your brief begins by saying, we aren't in favor of torture. Torture is not the policy of the United States. Why does the military need protection for torture?
Let's take a step back and look at what this type of Bivens action would look at. Okay?
No. I mean, your position has to be it doesn't matter if they hung them up in the ceiling and were electrically shocking them. There's no remedy.
Well,
for the individuals. Maybe
as our brief points out, there is an administrative remedy up to $100,000 can be granted. That's what Congress provided.
And
it provided
the final decision maker is the secretary.
That's what Congress decided. The question
is, let's talk about what Congress decided in the Detainee Treatment Act, where it provided a good faith defense in civil actions against U.S. military personnel involved in detaining and torturing or accused of interrogating aliens. Okay. And that's a good faith defense, not the absolute immunity you're seeking. What civil actions do you think Congress was referring to in the Detainee Treatment Act, if not Bivens actions?
I'll answer that, but first let me take, you say we're seeking an immunity. We're not seeking immunity. It's a question of who should create the cause of action, the courts or Congress. At the time, there could be a variety of civil actions. There could have been international law tort actions brought under the Alien Tort Statute. We had at the time, sometimes detainees were bringing actions under the RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We also had other the TVPA claims, Torture Victim Protection Act claims were sometimes tried to be brought against U.S. officials as well.
All of which are fairly exotic. I mean, medical students, I think, are taught the old adage, when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. And the horses here seem like they would be Bivens actions.
In that last sentence of that very section you're citing, it was very clear Congress was saying, we're not creating any rights.
We know that.
We're not creating any remedies, and we're not taking any
defenses.
But
it's not an absolute defense.
And Stanley expressly holds that the question of immunity is separate from the question of recognizing a cause of action or not. So if you would give me a liberty just to describe what this action would look like and how it would be disruptive and intrusive into the military matters.
Yeah, but before you get to that, I mean, because you keep saying, well, there would be legislation is what's going to save us, but if we grant this blanket immunity, you request, what prevents the Secretary of Defense from ignoring legislation on military matters he disagrees with? So let's assume Congress passes a statute that would
Congress is not powerless. It has oversight. It has committees. It can drag the secretary before them and put him under oath as to whether he's acting consistent with the law or not. And that is what they have done. For example, in 2007 and 2008, there was an extensive Senate Armed Services investigation regarding detainee matters, questioning of abuse at Guantanamo and Iraq and Afghanistan, where the highest level officials were brought before the Senate. And there were also before Congress, there have been 9 different investigations where Congress has shown great oversight as to looking at what's going on with the detainees, what are the policies, and how they're being carried out. If this, there, people can be politically accountable as under.
Well, can Congress create a damages remedy for this conduct, or are you suggesting it's presidential prerogative? Since the president is the commander in chief, and you're talking about activities in.
We are not making that latter argument, Judge Posner. But
in the absence of such statute, there could still be injunctive relief.
Well, the APA, as even the panel recognized, bars a court from issuing injunctive relief regarding matters during an armed conflict in a war zone.
Any constitutional practice can be enjoined, can it?
There may be some possibility of against the secretary.
What would the uncertainty be? I don't understand. I mean, what?
Well, the injunctive relief generally run under the APA, and the APA has an expressed exclusion from the waiver of sovereign immunity for injunctive actions.
Why would it have to be under the APA? Why not under 1331?
Well, I think. One would assume that although the APA doesn't completely exclude other sort of ex parte young actions, that if Congress has made an express exception, that a court went then using its sort of common law powers under 1330.
Ex parte, I don't understand. I would think any unconstitutional practice could be ignored.
Well, that would. I'm not going to take issue with that. In that, it only furthers our case that there's no need for a court to step in here.
If you look at the 14th Amendment, you have Section 1983 creates a damages remedy, but you don't need a statute, do you, to be able to enjoin unconstitutional
actions? With the federal government, those actions are traditionally brought. The waiver of immunity is the Administrative Procedure Act. But that.
So you're saying without the Administrative Procedure Act, but you could certainly enjoin the officials, couldn't you?
And if you can, that only
you would need something sort of like a Bivens action in order to do so, because
the Supreme Court
there's
is
jurisdiction
treated,
under 1331.
The Supreme Court has treated the last.
Counsel, trying to talk over a judge who is asking a question is not a productive strategy. Please wait until the judge has finished.
I was trying to draw the distinction between a jurisdictional statute and the statute that creates the right of action. And if there is no statute, then at least Bivens says there might be an implied right of action under the Constitution. Now, we know that the court hasn't been eager to create new Bivens remedies, but I think in partial response to what Judge Posner was saying is you need to find the statute or the right of action beyond just finding jurisdiction.
Right. For a damage action, you need to find a statute provided a cause of action, or you need to find that special factors
and
presented.
And what about injunctions, is what Judge Posner was saying. Why do you just pluck injunctions out of the sky?
Why do we pluck injunctions out of the sky?
Do you not need a statute or something like that for an injunction? If these people wanted an injunction, which I believe they might, against the Secretary of Defense, whoever it may be, in his official capacity, not to engage in torturing people with extremely loud music and sleep deprivation. I have images of guar being blasted through the air or something awful like that. But if you needed that injunction, then would your position be that that could go forward in this case?
In this case, it would be moot because they've been released and there's no basis for injunctive relief here. And also, a court would have to look at whether it would be able to use that common law authority where Congress has expressly barred relief. If you look at the Seminole...
But suppose it was somebody right now. I mean, forget about these guys. Or maybe they're on their way back to Iraq and they're afraid it's going to happen to them again or something. Would you agree that that kind of injunctive relief would be possible?
We haven't briefed that, Your Honor. I don't have the Solicitor General's position on that. I don't want to, but I would think that
if
you would
see how Congress could pass a statute saying that there's no remedy for violating the Constitution. That I mean, I think it's an injunction seems to me to be implicit in having a Constitution which, you know, is Constitution says is the supreme law, right? Has to be honored.
Correct, Your Honor. But there are instances where, as we know, because now the Bivens actions aren't always recognized, where there's not always a damage remedy provided for a constitutional law.
I just want to make sure that at least there's an injunctive remedy. Doesn't provide retrospective relief, of course, but it does enable these practices to be brought to an end if they're unconstitutional.
Right. In the Supreme Court Seminole Tribe case, and looking at injunctive relief in the state context, they did look to a similar special factor analysis that they applied to the damages. But again, we haven't briefed that. I don't want to take any firm position on the injunctive relief here.
I don't know why you didn't brief it in a way, because at least the amici in this case place great stress on what they describe as a wide range of other measures beyond a Bivens action that would deter. Certainly nothing would compensate aside from this unsatisfactory remedy that ends up with the guilty party deciding whether he has violated somebody's rights and thus should have to compensate them. Doesn't seem too great. But I would have thought you would have thought about injunctive relief.
We agree that is one of the special factors in that you have this military justice system if there's someone has abused a detainee, they are subject. We know there have been numerous dozens and dozens of people who have been charged with court martials for mistreating people at Abu Ghraib and other detention facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan.
In normal cases, let's say, the existence of a criminal remedy has never been thought to displace somebody's 1983 action.
And we don't make that argument, Your Honor.
Making that argument. You're saying that there are criminal remedies and there are UCMJ remedies against the abusers, and thus that's enough. End of story.
No, we're arguing you have to look at all the special factors in an aggregate, and that is a factor.
Excuse me, counsel, but I thought, in fact, throughout this case, at least until your reply brief to the panel, you had never taken the position that there were adequate alternatives under step one of the Bivens analysis.
Well,
correct?
We have certainly emphasized that in our rehearing petition, Your Honor.
So it's a brand new these alternative remedies are a brand new argument on rehearing, correct?
We do mention a reply, but I agree with you, Your
Honor.
You
mentioned it only with respect to the lost laptops.
I agree with that, Your
Honor. Correct?
But I think it's appropriate. The court's being asked to use its common law authority here to create a money damage action in an extraordinary context. There is this existence of a statute.
And these alternatives were so important in this important case that they were never noticed by the defense until rehearing.
They were emphasized on rehearing. Obviously, we don't argue here that that's an adequate remedy here. That's not a court remedy, but it's what Congress has provided. And certainly the court should be taking that into consideration.
Let me ask you about the Torture Victim Protection Act, counsel. As you know, federal law provides that an alien who is a victim of torture by her own government can sue in the United States courts. You're taking the position that a U.S. citizen tortured by his own government could not sue the responsible officers in U.S. courts, and I'm troubled by the conflict.
Well, when the TVPA was enacted, there was a palpable concern by many in the legislature and by the president that it would not draw in a torture suits against U.S. military officials.
It has to be someone acting under color of foreign law, correct?
Color of foreign law. But right. There was concern there that they were not intending to extend a damage remedy against U.S. military officials acting abroad. If you look at the President First Bush's signing statement, he expressly says that.
So you're satisfied with a position that says aliens who are tortured by their governments can sue in federal courts, but U.S. citizens cannot?
That's a legislative choice as to
the legislative choice that's made.
Well, in a domestic prison context, they would have a remedy under the Eighth Amendment. We're talking about, is there to be allowed a damage remedy against military officials for what they do in the conduct of a military affair abroad? And that's a question that Congress didn't provide that damage remedy. They could have under the TVPA, and they didn't. The question is, should a court step in and do what Congress did not?
If Rumsfeld loses this case and had to pay damages, would they be reimbursed?
There's no right to reimbursement,
by the government,
Your Honor. There is no right to reimbursement. There is no right to reimbursement, Your Honor.
Is there discretion to reimburse?
An application can be made, and there is discretion for reimbursement. But there's, especially in these tight fiscal times, there isn't a lot of money to be paying extra damage remedies on behalf of individuals who are being sued.
Is he the only official who's been sued?
Your Honor, they added 26.
Do they have other people?
Counsel, I wish you would allow the judge to finish the question. This is not The Price is Right.
Have there been other defendants in this case besides Rumsfeld and the United States?
They amended their complaint to add John Doe defendants, and through discovery they've gotten the names of these 26 additional officials.
You now have 5 minutes remaining.
26 officials who were the ones, the line guards and the interrogators in this case. And this
do those officials include people in the Defense Department like Rumsfeld?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. But it just highlights what this case is going to look like. We're going to need depositions and testimony from all of those 26 people. And we're going to have to get depositions and testimony from people through the entire chain of command. Also, their claims are based on General Sanchez's a memorandum from 2004, which giving instructions about how to treat people. That memorandum says there shall be no food deprivation. There shall be no sleep deprivation. There's food manipulation, changing, giving them...
But let me suggest, I think that's a two-edged sword for you, because as I understand the plaintiff's position, their whole point is that the treatment that these people received was flatly against U.S. law, was against the standards articulated in the Detainee Treatment Act, was against some of these other memos, and so these were rogue people from the Secretary of Defense on down, is their theory, although you in your brief suggest that maybe you can't trace it all the way up to the Secretary of Defense. I don't know. But their theory is certainly that these were actions contrary to law, not questions of judgment, like is it okay to do food deprivation or not. It was clear that it wasn't.
Your Honor, respectfully, this 2003 directive from General Sanchez is used by them to show an example of how Secretary Rumsfeld transmitted his illegal instructions down to the lower levels. And so these things are given just contrary instructions. And they don't give instructions to slam people into walls or to keep them deprived sleep or deprive them of food or deprive them medical care. You know, they just say ipsy-dixy in their complaints that all this is responsible through this memorandum and up to Secretary Rumsfeld. So let's think about the dangers. If you identify these 26 individuals here, think of the deterrence effects. You not only have the disruption of the depositions of these 26 individuals, plus everyone up and down the chain of command, you also have a deterrence against people wanting to take these jobs. It's like you're in the fog of war. They're picking up some 10,000 security detainees in Iraq at a time, trying to figure out who they are. Are they bad guys or not? Are they a security risk? And most of these guys are just released in a couple weeks or a month, just like the plaintiffs here. And what the message going out here is, if you're the interrogator, you're the guard, we're going to give your name and addresses to the security detainees because they could sue you and they could get your personal name. And if I have that job as an interrogator or as a guard, I'm going to be very concerned about if I want to do those jobs where my personal name is going to come out there years later in a lawsuit.
Sure. I mean, I understand that, although I would say that there are urban police departments where the police officers operate under very, very difficult circumstances. And as you said a few minutes ago, they are subject to the kind of accountability. People can make allegations against them. They're often incorrect or, you know, frivolous allegations and the like. But we have a system for dealing with that.
Well, if Congress wants to provide a remedy which is going to create the disruption and the interference by having the interrogation and the testimony of people from the top of command on down and from the bottom of command down out to find out what happened, what were the policies, how were they communicated, what actually happened
on
the ground.
Didn't Congress do that when it said we'll give you this good faith immunity in the Detainee Treatment Act?
Your Honor, respectfully, we don't think it's a a reasonable reading of that to say that Congress has, by doing so, authorized a cause of action. That's a far reach, especially given Stanley saying immunity and the special factors inquiry is a separate matter. I'll reserve my remaining minute for rebuttal.
Mr. Rifkin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm David Rifkin on behalf of Amici. If I may begin by briefly tackling Judge Henderson's question as to whether or not the alternative remedies inquiry is new to this case. If you look at the significant portion of the defendant's brief in the motion to dismiss on page 6 and 7, they get into quite a bit of a discussion, albeit in the context of the special factors analysis, discussing the vigor of UCMJ and operating in a way that is exactly consistent with the Supreme Court's approach in Stanley and Chappelle.
I don't think that's the issue.
Well,
it's the business of the legislature to create a damages remedy. That's what they did when they passed 1983. That's what they should do here. This is obviously a very difficult area, and the court shouldn't be making up the details of the damages remedy. That's why Bivens hasn't been extended. Bivens is a very questionable decision. It's not the business of court.
That is exactly
if a statute or a practice that's unconstitutional can be enjoined. But when it gets to the question of providing a remedy for people injured by it in the past, that's for Congress to do.
That is exactly right, Judge Posner. And in fact, the Supreme Court teaching in Malesko is that at the very heart of figuring out whether or not this common law remedy should be created, which, of course, as we know, is very much a disfavored activity for Article III courts in our constitutional system. The court should be concerned solely with the question of deterrence, deterring individual officers from acting unconstitutionally.
Deterrence from waging war. Because imagine how officials are going to respond to the existence of a damages remedy of this sort, right?
That is absolutely.
They're not going to open their mouths without a lawyer sitting next to them.
That is absolutely.
Telling them what to do and what they can't do. I'm very disturbed by the notion that you're a high government official. You're Rumsfeld. You have a thankless job. You're fired. You're subject to all sorts of criticism, probably entirely meritorious. I'm not going to defend Rumsfeld. But in addition, you leave office and you're trailed by all the lawyers and the plaintiffs trying to soak you for damages, and you spend the rest of your life defending yourself in court. Now, who wants to be a public official in those circumstances? Or these other 26 people, whoever they are, right?
We agree.
Don't stop with just suing Rumsfeld. You look for anybody you might tie into this, and you whack them with a damages suit, and they spend years defending it, and they try maybe to get reimbursement from the government without success. I mean, this has to have a big impact on your conduct of national defense.
We agree wholeheartedly, Your Honor, and to emphasize, not only the remedial scheme created by Congress with UCMJ at its heart is more deterrence-laden. If I had more time, I would describe
Rifkin,
it in some detail than any.
Mr. Rifkin, let me ask you about that, if I could. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court revisited this area and talked about alternative remedies needing to provide, to satisfy Bivens at step one, needing to provide roughly similar incentives for defendants to comply with the law and roughly similar compensation to victims of violation. How does the UCMJ fulfill that latter prong?
With respect, we agree that the Supreme Court teaching as to the roughly similar deterrence, and we would argue here that, again, the nature of UCMJ provides enormous deterrence because of a must-investigate function.
So put aside the compensation.
The Supreme Court teaching is absolutely clear. In case after case, Supreme Court has mentioned that compensation is not a required feature of Bivens' remedy.
We know it's not in particular cases, but roughly similar compensation?
No. The compensation, for example, in Schweiger versus Schlicky, the court was faced with a situation that specifically confronted the objection, but the remedial scheme at most gave you the Social Security disability package which you otherwise be entitled. You get absolutely nothing for the additional constitutional violations that have been attendant
so
to
what do you
losing
think,
it.
What
That's
do you think the Supreme Court meant in January when it said roughly similar comments?
Well, in my opinion, I presume you're talking about the Menachie case, the court is looking in this case, very different situation here. We have state law. Remember, special factors are not present. The political branches did not create it. There's no foreign affairs or national security involved. By looking at state law, and in this situation, perhaps the tailoring of remedial action found in state law is closer to what a Bivens remedy would have provided.
Well, you know, the government is taking the position that military contractors who torture people can be sued under American law. They've taken that position in the Fourth Circuit. But we should not allow that against the folks who actually are doing the torturing if they wear uniforms.
Again,
these contractors are armed and uniformed, aren't they?
Depending on, Judge Posner, depending on their functions, yes, some of them are. But if I may again emphasize how clearly the Supreme Court in this very circuit.
Your time has expired, so if you have a direct answer to Judge Hamilton, that's fine.
Yes.
But otherwise.
Right. My direct answer is that Bivens.
Pass the lectern.
Forgive me. Is enormously disfavored activity and easily displaced by the Congress addressing the very limited standard. All you need to make sure, unlike preemption of state law, in displacement cases, the Congress has addressed the issue. And the Congress most certainly did so. Thank you very much.
Counsel? Canada.
Good afternoon. I'm Mike Kanovitz. I represent the plaintiffs in this case, Donald Vance and Nathan Rattel. May it please the court. In seeking to have this court reverse the district court's findings, the defendant is making a stark argument that the judicial branch has absolutely no role to play when American citizens loyal
to it has a role to play. The question is whether in a damages suit, it doesn't play that role until Congress decides what kind of damages remedy, if any, to provide. I don't see what's wrong with letting Congress have a role here.
Your Honor, I agree with you that the court, the judicial branch, most unequivocally has a role to play because Hamdi teaches us that the judicial branch has a role to play even in wartime. When it comes to torture, and I appreciate the court's suggestion about
if you look at the Constitution, it has very detailed provisions with regard to the regulation of the military. That's something even in 1787 they were very concerned with. And you know, give Congress comprehensive regulatory authority over the military, and the president has some ill-defined command authority. So why not leave it to Congress to decide what kind of remedies are appropriate? I mean, given what I think is fundamental, which is that any unconstitutional practice can be enjoined, but when it comes to whether you provide damages, whether you make these public officials liable personally after they've left office, that's a very tricky question. I don't think the judges have any comparative advantage in deciding, in weighing the factors pro and con of damages remedy.
I believe that the court system has an obligation to hear claims like this.
Where it does cannot, that come from, that obligation?
It comes from checks and balances. It comes from 1331.
It comes from checks and balances. Whether these people have a damages remedy or not, how is that going to disturb checks and balances?
It is part of checks and balances to make sure they have a remedy, because without a remedy, the court system
but
cannot
often
act.
Often there are not retrospective remedies, right? It's a matter, as you say, when you say checks and balances, I would say it's a matter of balancing considerations. Is it healthy to subject these public officials to damages suits after they leave office?
There is no prospective remedy for torture. Torture takes place incommunicado.
No, prospective remedy against a practice. torture can be enjoined, and people who violate an injunction, they are subject to heavy penalties, criminal and civil, no question about that.
A torture victim has no access to a court with which to seek an injunction. That is not a sort of claim that a court can hear as a practical matter. So for the judicial branch...
Well, why not? I didn't understand.
Because torture takes place incommunicado. The purpose of torture is so that the torturers can overcome the will of the person that's being tortured, and they don't give them access to a court in the
process.
Well,
if the government takes the position that it's allowed to torture people, you can certainly have a suit by contractors or what have you seeking to enjoin the torture practice.
I'm sorry, the predicate is if Congress takes the position that torture...
Suppose it's the practice of our military to torture people. Well, then the prospective torturers, I would think, but certainly prospective tortured people, like contractors, wouldn't they be able to seek an injunction?
To me, they would not, because under your theory, the DTA sets very clearly that it is not military. It violates military policy to engage in torture. So what we're talking about is how can a court act when... officials violate the law that Congress has already passed to regulate this.
I thought you had developed a record of these reports where the practices were contrary to the regulations, statutes. I thought that's what was the basis that Rumsfeld had involved.
Well, that's not the sole basis. The reports of which you speak inform Mr. Rumsfeld about the practices that were going on prior to the DTA.
But that same information...
That's prior to the DTA. Post-DTA, the Congress has said unequivocally, actually they said it in the NDAA, but in the DTA they made clear even which tactics are allowable and which are not. The basis of Mr. Rumsfeld's...
And your complaint to allege that the practices continued.
They did continue.
So isn't that what would allow victims to obtain relief in the form of injunction?
They would, once they are actually victimized by the practice, they have no access to a court.
I thought you were saying that there was almost a lion's kind of problem. Once they're released, as Mr. Vance and Mr. Ertel are, unless there's some reason to think they're going to be tortured again, they wouldn't have any entitlement to seek an injunction.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like the chokehold. Once it's over, you have no reason, particularly when Congress has acted and said this is not part of our military policy.
Right.
It
so
should never
happen.
You have
to find a person who had standing somehow to raise this claim.
Which would be a person who is currently being choked, i.e. tortured, and that person has no access to a court. And that is one of the most important reasons why in Bivens it was recognized that a court can imply a remedy in order to prevent rights from becoming merely precatory.
I have a different line of questions I want to ask you. Because one of the things that concerns me is the assumption in your complaint that Secretary Rumsfeld had in fact authorized all of these deplorable tactics, and that kind of goes to the heart of your supervisory liability claim. Nobody here is certainly defending these exact practices, and somebody out there in the world perhaps should be called to account for them under Bivens or under something else. But this part of this case seems to be all about the former Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. And I don't know what he was talking about. I mean, assuming that this hypothetical secret 10-page supplement was there to the Army Field Manual, I don't know whether he was talking about enemy combatants. I don't know whether he was talking about Iraqis captured in the field. I don't know whether he was talking about anything. So it seems to me there is a vagueness in what you're asserting that makes it very hard for this case to go forward.
Let me try to clarify the vagueness then. Consistent with the record. Mr. Rumsfeld approves a list of tactics from outside of the field manual for Guantanamo.
Alleged. Oh, okay, for Guantanamo.
Okay. Yes. Then he sends...
But does he say that they're to be used against U.S. citizen contractors?
At that point in time, I believe there is one American citizen at Guantanamo. Then he orders Major General Miller...
Who's a detainee, even, who isn't a contractor like these...
Correct. That is correct. He orders Major Jeffrey Miller to transfer those to operational intelligence for Iraq, and he receives many, many reports that show the techniques from outside of the field manual are being used in Iraq.
But that, see, that's what I'm saying, are being used against whom? I guess I, in some ways, share what Judge Posner was concerned about, in that if we're going to be in the business of actually allowing actions against a cabinet officer to go forward, I, for one, would like to know what he did wrong at a fairly high, extreme level of specificity. And right now, there are these bad tactics on the one hand, and there's the result on the other hand, and there's a chain between Secretary Rumsfeld and what happened that seems pretty long.
I don't believe it is that long. There's the Gitmoization of Iraq, which is at his command. There is the knowledge that, these techniques are being used on people in custody in Iraq, and he has knowledge that American citizens are being not only being detained in Iraq at that point in time, but furthermore that there are over 100,000 American citizens working in Iraq at that time.
But why is that different from the warden of a prison being aware that there's a certain amount of prison rape going on or gang violence in the prison, although the warden at any given moment certainly hasn't condoned it and may not know who's doing what to whom?
Well,
in those cases, fail on respondeat superior supervisory liability grounds.
I believe that if you're talking about the Farmer versus Brennan scenario, they actually do succeed on that.
It depends on how specific the information is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought part of your complaint in this case was that Secretary Rumsfeld had issued orders that some of these enhanced interrogation techniques were to be used only on his personal approval.
There was that portion of it. And based upon that, there is an inference, a very fair inference to be drawn from the complaint, that because those were used on our clients, on Mr. Vance and Mr. Hertel, they were approved directly by Mr. Rumsfeld.
How do you There's know also
that specifically refers to the classification allegation, and that is I don't know exactly where we know the 10 pages from, but there have been newspaper articles on that issue.
So why do you put such? I'm sorry.
Newspaper article.
That is where we understand the classification allegation from.
So that some newspaper article said Rumsfeld issued 10 pages an amendment to the Army Field.
It's the New York Times, and it's not just the New
Does
York
that
Times.
Make it better?
We're at the pleading stage. You know, the evidence that we will be able to gather.
At the pleading stage. We're talking about newspapers.
Yes, but in my opinion, a newspaper article from a trustworthy source is enough to make a factual allegation that's entitled to the presumption of truth at this stage. And then, you know, the evidentiary issues are what we're supposed to get to if we get past this stage. So yes, that is what we have, and I believe that is sufficient to make a factual allegation at this stage.
Why do you place such emphasis on the fact these are U.S. citizens?
Because citizenship matters in this context.
I mean, what if these contractors they could be lawful residents of the United States but not citizens, or they could be obviously allies of the United States from countries, you know, like Great Britain that we have close relationships to? Why should they be treated differently?
If you look at Eisentrager, each of the...
Now, give me a practical reason. Why should they be treated differently?
Well, when you use the analysis for special factors, which is before the court, alienage raises special factors that aren't present in the...
But you can torture the aliens. I don't understand.
Counsel, does our Treaty of Friendship, Commerce, and Navigation with the United Kingdom allow us to deny its nationals a remedy given to U.S. citizens?
I do not know the answer to that question.
It's a serious problem. We've promised the English, and the Canadians for that matter, to give their citizens what's called under these treaties national treatment, which means in litigation they're treated the same as U.S. citizens. But it looks like, to me, you may be urging us to violate our treaties with the United Kingdom and Canada, which is, I assume, not your goal.
Fair enough. Yes, absolutely.
I'd like to ask you a concrete question. Mm-hmm. Have your clients sought compensation under any of the schemes that are available, like the Military Claims Act or the Foreign Claims Act?
I think those are both essentially the same scheme in this context.
Well, they're similar. Yeah. They're different statutes. They're different bodies that award the compensation. One is the head of JAG, and the other is a special commission. But my question is, have your clients asked?
They have not.
They have not.
Are there
I think maybe you'd have a stronger position if your clients had asked and been told, go fish, we don't care. But as I understand those statutes, each of them offers up to $100,000 per person in compensation for somebody who was injured by the wrongful conduct of military personnel.
I'm not clear that they do in this context.
That's what it says.
Well,
if
talks
you had
about
asked and they had said, we ain't participating or you haven't got a good claim under these statutes, that would be interesting. But if you haven't asked, it seems very difficult for you to come to us and say, well, we predict that if we ask, we would be wrongfully refused, and therefore we want money from the Secretary of Defense personally.
May I make 2 points in response?
Certainly.
The first point is, as I read those statutes, they talk about non-combat injuries, and from the allegations that the defendants painted, I don't know that we would fit within that hoop. But assuming that we would, that it is not a form of compulsory compensation. It is completely discretionary. And I think that the relevant analytic there is
that's why you need to ask, right? If you'd gone and they said, we have discretion, we're not exercising discretion to award damages to people injured in war zones, then you could come to us and say, you know, we've got a much stronger case that the executive branch is freezing us out. But you fail to ask, you then can't come to us and say, well, we know it's damages against the Secretary or nothing, because there are two statutes that seem to negate the or nothing possibility.
I think that it doesn't make for a stronger case whether we asked and were refused or not, because the issue for purposes of the Wilkie two-stage analysis is there something similar to what we see in Chalicki and Bush, which is compulsory compensation coupled with due process, meaningful opportunity to participate, coupled with judicial review. In each of those instances where the Supreme Court has said other forms of
remedies. But if you take seriously at all the fact that these civil damages suits unlimited in amount can interfere with our ability to conduct national security, then you might say, well, they certainly ought to exhaust these more moderate remedies in which the government would be paying the money rather than individuals before they jump into court.
I believe that this particular
force these people to hire a lot of lawyers and so on.
I believe that this particular circumstance does not present a significant threat of interfering with Congress's military policy.
How do you know about how people in the military react to the ubiquitous litigation on the part of people who disapprove of what they do?
Well, Congress, in my belief, addressed this special factor in the DTA immunity.
No, they
provision.
Didn't. They provided an immunity. They didn't know what kind of lawsuits might be brought. Look, let me get back to saying this question of the injunctive remedy. Why isn't this a good case for the principle of waiving mootness when you have a claim that is capable of repetition but evades review? So suppose you're a contractor, go to Iraq, you're detained, maybe you're mistreated, you're released, you're exonerated, you're still working for this company, they want to send you back to Iraq. Well, you're worried, you get into trouble there, so couldn't you seek an injunction?
There was a lot of assumptions in that question, obviously. I don't know that they would intend to go back or ever be willing to go back. The war in which this took place is over. It now seems clear that the
war went on for 10 years, right? So there were plenty of opportunities for contractors, the thousands and thousands of contractors, to encounter this problem of mistreatment of detainees, and yet they're still in the contractor military support business. And
there would have to be a basis to believe that the problem still substantially exists as well, in addition to the capable of repetition yet evading review branch.
Ms. Kanowitz, assuming you were successful in getting past the motion to dismiss stage, do you envision a deposition with Secretary Rumsfeld in which you would inquire about his discussions with the President of the United States on the policies that you were challenging?
I don't envision that.
You preclude it?
I don't preclude it either. What I envision is that we would take a very, very serious look at the mass of publicly available information as it exists at this point in time, and that the district court would at first decide what is a discovery that we're allowed to do beyond what already exists. And I expect the district court would exercise very tight control, and a deposition is not necessarily going to be required in all circumstances. Part of it, I suppose, would also depend on what defenses the defendant tells the district court he would want to offer. But I don't think that that is a necessary predicate.
How about a deposition inquiry with regard to the general counsel of the Department of Defense?
I think that we have the Bivey memos and the things that we have. It does not require a deposition.
But you don't preclude it.
I don't, but I
think... I mean, I'm not putting you in a box. I'm just trying to unfold where we go post a motion to dismiss.
I appreciate that. I don't preclude it, but I do expect very serious management by the district court, and that it may very well be appropriate to order us to make our case on the public record. Right.
Now, discussions with the President of the United States, do you think that poses any... if an inquiry is made between the Secretary of Defense and... does that pose any special problems for the court?
I mean, it depends what questions are being asked. I could see circumstances where it would pose problems, and that's the reason why control should be tight.
But it's precisely the threat of that kind of judicial intrusion and judicial decision-making on a case-by-case basis that constitutes a special factor under the Bivens analysis for not recognizing a damages claim. The intrusion that would create an inhibition in military policymaking, not just at a high level, but in the field, on the front lines level in detention situations, it would constitute a significant inhibition, just the threat of being subjected to those kinds of judicial decisions.
There is a lot of potential intrusions that arise when a court considers a lawsuit between military and civilians. Those are addressed, we believe, substantially by the DTA. Even in the Stanley case, where it was thrown out, the court says specifically, we're not going to draw a line that says no intrusion. We're going to draw what we believe to be a clear administrable line that allows some intrusion, because, for example, they did not say that members of the military can never bring a claim against the military. What they said is they can't bring a claim if it involves something that is incident to service. A line that obviously doesn't translate over when you're talking about the very important area where there's a military action against a civilian.
Rumsfeld really a civilian in a meaningful sense? He's the delegate of the president, who's the commander-in-chief, and all the orders from the president go through the Secretary of Defense to the various combat combatants. He's really part of the military. But
we're not treating him as a civilian, and I didn't mean my answer.
Pardon?
We're not treating him as a civilian, and I did not mean my answer to suggest that. I was speaking about the plaintiff being a civilian and the actor being
a civilian. Well, this is the plaintiff, the civilian. I don't care. That's so unrealistic. Look, what's happened, partly in order to conceal certain expenditures, but also to avoid getting into arguments over how large the military ought to be, a great many military functions in recent years have been assigned to these so-called contractors. Many of them armed, many of them in uniform, probably most of them are ex-military. Are they meaningfully civilian rather than military personnel?
Yes, they are meaningfully civilian.
No, I don't see that. What is the difference?
Well, a military personnel has a slew of protections under the UCMJ that people who are not enlisted members, official members of the military, contractors, do not have those rights. So the question is, given that we've got Hamdi...
But what's the meaningful distinction? Right?
The meaningful...
Because presumably you're not allowing the military officers to... military personnel to be sued under your theory, are you?
No, I think that would violate Stanley.
Okay, so you're somehow distinguishing between these contractors and the official military, and yet there's no practical difference.
There is a very practical difference.
What's the practical difference?
The practical difference is that the civilian only has the ability to have due process protections via a remedy in court, whereas the military have many of those protections under the UCMJ, much more so than a different
case. I'm asking you for a practical difference, statutory difference.
I believe that to be a practical difference.
What is the practical difference between these contractors and the military?
Well, is the problem that there may not be one, except there is this formal difference in their rights that you're talking about? So the civilian, you know, whether they're rebuilding the roads or trying to build schools or they're providing security or whatever, are in a sense naked out there, whereas the military people are inside the cocoon of the military.
Well, but that's the question, right? You want to create a right. And my question is there a meaningful difference between these people whom you want to give rights to and military people who don't have these rights?
Yes, there is a meaningful difference. Military people cannot be victimized in the way that the civilian can be in this circumstance. And in Hamdi, it's clear that the judicial branch is supposed to be there to enforce their constitutional rights in wartime. Whereas the UCMJ...
But the military, the soldiers can bring a damages suit?
No. They have a slew of other rights under the UCMJ and a slew of administrative rights to financial compensation that the civilians do not have.
Well, do you think they should have the identical rights as the contractors?
I don't think that they have to be identical.
That's not my question. Do you think they should? Forget about the USMJ. Do you think that if we were writing on a blank slate, the uniformed military should have these people are uniformed, that the official military should have the same civil remedies as these contractors?
I don't. I think that there is a...
Why not?
Because there is a genuine Article 1 difference when you're talking about intramilitary affairs and what courts can do and when you're talking about what happens...
That's a genuine difference. That sounds very artificial to me. I don't know why you shrink from that. If it's good for the contractors, it's good for the military. Maybe, you know, statutory obstacles and so on. But is there some reason why military people shouldn't have the same rights as the contractors?
I think
Mr. Kanovitz, before you begin, you have 5 minutes left.
Thank you, Judge. I think that there is a reason, which is Congress has given the military members a slew of rights.
No, you're not tracking my question. Forget about existing law.
Okay.
If we were starting over just with the Constitution, no statutes, would there be any reason why military people should have different rights against their superiors than the contractors have?
Do I assume Article 1 issues, or is it that blank of a slate?
I don't think there's an Article 1 issue, but if you want...
If we're not concerned about Congress's control over the military, then of course members of the military...
But if you're concerned about Congress's control over the military, you're certainly concerned about the contractors, because they're de facto part of the military in Iraq and Afghanistan.
It would be...
You're just making a formal distinction.
I don't believe I am. There's a
substantive... Yes, you are, because you're not telling me what the difference is factually between these contractors and these military people.
Contractors have no protection.
That's the conclusion. Don't you understand? Forget about legal documents. Tell me, as an original matter, if you're drafting a code for giving people damages rights, is there any reason to differentiate between military personnel and contractors for the military?
On a completely blank slate, other than the issue of determining how closely the contractor has to be to a military function, I believe that they should be parallel. But there are many contractors and people who are in war zones who are citizens that have no military function at all, including the embedded journalist, the aid worker, that are discussed specifically in Hamdi when the Supreme Court is talking about the role of the judiciary in affording some sort of remedy to protect individual rights in wartime.
Counsel, could I ask you two questions about that? One, isn't the United States government telling us that there's a difference in that contractors can be sued for torture in the Fourth Circuit cases, but that military personnel cannot? Is that the position the government is taking?
That's my understanding of how the case is played out.
And second, the defense position in this case would seek immunity for claims not only from military contractors, but also from journalists or aid workers or other civilians who are present in the area, correct?
Absolutely. It is completely sweeping. There would be no power for the judicial branch to do what the judicial branch is expected to do, which is to hear any sort of claim. There is no judicial review.
That's not true. We've already established that there is a remedy available to halt ongoing violations, right? Either injunctive or in habeas, in the case of detentions.
Well, habeas governs the length of detention, not the conditions. And then the injunctive remedy, you have to have access to a court. And people who are being tortured do not have access to a court.
Right, but we're talking about a judicially created damages remedy, which is all about judicial policy making, right? And so we're tasked with making a very sensitive policy judgment, and that's why the Supreme Court says go slowly, defer to Congress, don't get out ahead of the political branches. And so I haven't heard a satisfactory answer to the problem of over-deterrence in this situation and the fact that the damages remedy that you want us to create in this situation, and that's what we would be doing. We would be creating a new damages remedy. So we're sitting as a common law court doing what common law courts do all the time, weighing the costs and benefits and, you know, detriments to military policy in this situation in making that judgment. And there's a significant risk of over-deterrence here, as has been identified by your opponents, that military decision makers on the ground, high and low, will be inhibited from making decisions because of the threat of civil damages liability, and the judicial intrusion into that is too great a cost.
I think that could be true for generalized claims, but as to the particular claim
here... Where's the stopping point, though? We're not just talking about your particular claim, and you've got a lot of equities on your side. Everybody agrees with that. Okay, we're not just talking about this particular case, which is really bad. We're talking about mine-run cases of military detention, because that's what the consequences of a decision in your favor on the Bivens claim entails, is that mine-run detentions will be subject to damages actions, you know, compelling and not compelling.
I don't agree, Judge. I believe...
What's the stopping point?
The DTA is the stopping point. Congress has
Counsel,
acted...
Your metaphorical red light is on, but you can continue to respond as long as there are questions. So please continue
you,
to answer Judge Sykes' question.
Thank you, Judge. The DTA is where Congress addressed the very concern you have about over-deterrence, and it said that in the context of detainee abuse lawsuits, we don't need absolute immunity. And the DTA reflected a choice amongst alternatives. It could have gone up absolute immunity. It could have done jurisdiction stripping, as it did in the 2006 Military Commissions Act for the specific instance of Guantanamo. It chose not to do that. And I don't think that there is an interpretation of the DTA where you can say that Congress wasn't anticipating the issue of lawsuits when it drafted that legislation and that it didn't make a choice to not bar them entirely.
I think you're reading way too much into the good faith exception and asking us to overread it in terms of what Congress was trying to do. But
I understand, Judge. If there's no more questions.
It doesn't look like it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Loeb, you have 45 seconds left. I'll raise my hand when it runs out. But, of course, as I said to Mr. Kanovich, you can continue to respond to any question on the floor.
As to Chief Judge Easterbrook's point about the Military Claims Act, I'd point out that the statute of limitations in the statute says they have 2 years after the termination of the armed conflict, and hence they could still, to this day, file for that $100,000 per person claim, and they have not done so, but we invite them to do so if they wish.
Has there been any internal investigation of these plaintiffs' allegations?
They didn't raise those. When they filed their complaint here, that's the first time it was brought to the DOD's attention. An inquiry was initiated as to whether a more formal investigation should be conducted, and looking into the facts conducted by now Brigadier General Martins decided that the facts were not sufficient when they inquired into them to support a fuller sort of court-martial investigation into the matter. But, yes, it was looked into, Your Honor. And they point out as to the tying Secretary Rumsfeld down to the acts of the individual interrogators, again, to the Gitmoization of Iraq. And again, the critical piece to that is this 2005 Sanchez memorandum, which they say communicated to the people on the ground that they should be doing enhanced interrogation techniques, should be depriving people of food, depriving them of sleep. It says exactly the opposite. This is a public document that is available to the court. Finally, as to the secret, thank you, Your Honor. We ask that the court defer to Congress and overrule the district court.
The case is taken under advisement. The court will take a brief recess before calling the next case.